Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. Welcome back to the Eucharist Podcast. I'm Father Joshua.
I'm Father Ryan.
And Father Kyle is back with us.
Yeah.
Fresh from Israel, huh?
Fresh from Israel. It was a really phenomenal trip. The word that I keep using to describe it is illuminating. I think growing up reading the scriptures, even my entire life just reading the scriptures, my imagination has been muddled because I've never been able to see the topography of the land of Israel. But being able to see it with my own two eyes, I think really illumined my imagination to the scriptures. And so it's more exciting to go back and reread some of those places that I now can place in an actual physical area.
I've actually heard it called the fifth gospel.
I hate that word, though.
Yeah.
Sounds a little Gnostic, but I think we were picking up.
No, not Gnostic. Anti-Gnostic. It's material. It's like, the ground. It's the soil.
It just makes me a little uneasy.
It's a little too much.
But have you guys visited the fifth gospel? It's kind of like, oh, okay. But with all that saying, like, we should definitely take like a Eucharist trip there in the next 2 years or so. I think that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I'm down.
Yeah. Eucharist to Israel 2019. Mark it on your calendars. Just the whole year. Just plan ahead. All of 2019, just Israel Eucharist, all right? Mm. Anyway, so let's get into it. We're looking at chapter 2 of For the Life of the World by Father Alexander Schmemann. This chapter is called The Eucharist. So Kyle, can you get us started off? What is Father Alexander talking about in this chapter? Where is he going with it?
Well, on your first read through, it's kind of confusing on where he's taking it because he immediately jumps into something really heavy. He says, in this world, Christ was rejected. And he talks about how the condemnation of Christ in this world meant that it is impossible to recapture paradise in this world. Mm. This world is condemned. Now, that doesn't mean that we as humans shouldn't work towards justice and freedom and essentially improving on this world, but it does mean that we can't get back to where God intended it to be, which is the Garden of Eden.
And why is that? How has the world condemned itself, according to Father Schmemann?
Well, because Jesus was the perfect expression of what a human was intended to be in God. When we rejected Christ on the cross, we rejected the perfect expression of humanity.
Mm. It almost seems like he has in mind that, so when there was the creation and the fall, then it's almost like second option fill in here, which was like that if Israel accepted its Messiah, there could have been maybe some sort of restoration. He doesn't explicitly say that, but I feel like it's kind of in here. But then in the finality of God's own people rejecting the Creator, like that, there was something final about that.
Yeah, I think he says on the bottom of page 23, the world has condemned itself when on Calgary, it condemned the one who was its true self.
Did you just say Calgary?
Calgary? Well, sorry, that was from my time in living in Canada. Saw my friends in Calgary. Let me say that again. The world has condemned itself when on Calvary, it condemned the one who was its true self. But I think, I mean, that's really interesting, right? Like seeing Christ as representative of all of humanity, which we take for granted because we see him as our representative in our redemption, you know? But we don't often see us as the world who condemned him, you know, like we're the voice that cried crucify that day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is emphasized in this liturgical year as we go through Matthew, because Matthew's entire gospel is essentially saying Christ is the true Israel.
Hmm. And the early church picks up some of this notion too. I don't know who it is. I read this somewhere that they sometimes refer to the world or the creation is almost like the body, which was in the soul or the spirit being God's own presence, God's own spirit. And so in the rejection of its own soul, it is condemned in a sense. And so Jesus embodies the very life, the very source, the very center of
which
of
is
life.
Interesting because when we go to the fall and just the state of sin, sin is this kind of dislocating ourself from our true self or from our created intent, if that makes sense. So sin, one of the horrible aspects of sin is it is this deforming or marring of this original image and this kind of bifurcation of these two selves, you know?
But Schmemann continues on with this thought. He says that the death of Christ doesn't mark the end. It doesn't say that we can never recapture paradise, but is rather the death of Christ is the beginning of the end. Rather, it is through Jesus' death and resurrection that we can enter into him and join him in this journey towards recapturing paradise.
So there's like two parts there. There's like the in the death of Christ, we are the witnesses of the natural end of creation, because it's like it's creation has condemned itself. It, mm-hmm. it has no longer has hope in and of itself. Yeah. There's nothing there. But that end is also a beginning. And yeah. it's the beginning of a new kind of hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like we said earlier, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't seek improvement in the world.
Right.
But rather, this world is transparent.
But mm-hmm. it can never be, this world can never become on its own what it was intended to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it can never undo its betrayal of the light who came into the world.
Yeah.
But it can now be redeemed in its betrayal, if that makes sense. Its betrayal can be transformed. Yeah. Well, we can't go, undo what's been done.
It's through this darkness, the darkness of the cross, that joy can enter into the world.
So mm-hmm. there's like a huge paradox here. And, yeah. and so much of Christianity is centered around paradox. But I feel like this is like, he's captured it here. Like it's the end of natural joy, but the beginning of true joy.
Mm-hmm. It's a paradox, but it's also a little bit kind of almost like law gospel a bit. Like here's mm-hmm. the bad news. But here in the bad news is the good news, right? Yeah,
somebody get Joshua a microphone.
Oh, man. Oh, boy.
No, it's almost as if this Orthodox theologian is Lutheran in a way.
Aren't we all a little Lutheran?
So. Say it ain't so.
But okay, yeah.
So let's talk about joy for a bit, because we've said before on this podcast that Schmemann is a very joyful writer. Like he's very enamored by joy. His very theology is a theology of joy, actually. But that for him is not incompatible with recognizing... it doesn't make him an optimist, so to speak. You know, he's not just sort of like seeing rosy. He actually can see that the end, as we just have said, calls forth a new kind of joy.
And it's kind of funny because we have to remember that Alexander Schmemann is not just this non-denominational pastor who's just writing to our contemporary age. Like he was an Eastern Orthodox priest, highly liturgical. And often, you know, liturgy and stuff is not always associated with exuberant joy. Which is something that I think makes his voice stand out so much, is that he really embodies this vibrant joy in his life and in his writings. It just exudes from it. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows really what liturgy and the tradition is supposed to be, that somehow has gotten muddled, I think, in people's experience of it.
And he thinks that joy is so important that he basically says that like Christianity is unintelligible without the expression of joy.
Yeah, when he talks about Nietzsche, right?
Yeah, I love that.
He says that... of all accusations against Christians, the most terrible one was uttered by Nietzsche when he said that Christians have no joy.
Mm.
So when we go on and actually capture this joy or talk about it, he says joy is not something so much you can define or analyze, but it's mm-hmm. something that you enter into. And so there's a kind of mystery to joy that he wants to maintain there. And then he calls... This is how he brings himself to talk about the Eucharist, because he says the Eucharist is the very sacrament of joy. That's how he describes it.
Yeah.
So he shifts here to talk about, now that he's set up this whole dynamic, he shifts to talk about liturgy, because the Eucharist, as we receive it, it sits within a context, and that context is a liturgy. But he wants to define, like, what does he mean by liturgy? So let's talk about that for a minute. Like, what does he mean by liturgy?
I think that's a very interesting question, because I think he's meaning something by liturgy that goes a little bit deeper than I think many of us, when we kind of refer broadly to liturgy as like an order of service or, you know, things that you do on Sunday morning. He's going deeper with it, because he's saying it's not a thing about a church being liturgical or non-liturgical, but he's in a way defining liturgy as the work or the activity of the church itself, and not the church as an hour and a half on Sunday morning, but something that's more theologically rooted and deep. You know?
Yeah. He also talks about how liturgy is preparation for the coming of the Messiah.
Hmm. So in other words, he wants to broaden this back out and say that everything that the church does is liturgy. And by saying that, he's not trying to empty that of meaning. He's trying to fill it full of meaning. Mm-hmm. And he says, like, for instance, when the church gathers for the Sunday divine liturgy, that it's an action. He says, this is on page 25. He said it meant an action by which a group of people become something corporately, which they had not been as a mere collection of individuals, a whole greater than the sum of its parts. So this gathering together of individuals into this collective whole, something happens in that. And so the whole shape of what the church does together is liturgical.
I think that's so key. And I think that's a really strong word for our age, because so often with a digitalization of sermons and you know, digitalization of music and stuff, you can kind of piece together your own private liturgy, quote unquote. And so instead of actually going to meet with other people, you can just listen to a podcast, listen to Hillsong or Passion or whatever, and just kind of have your own experience. And he's like, no, that's not the same. There's something when we get together corporately, we're greater than merely the sum of our parts. And I think that's so key.
Yeah. Yeah, like at Eucharist, we just have a new processional cross, and we're going to bless it as a pastoral staff. I could easily bless it by myself, but I think it's more meaningful when we all come together and bless it as a corporate group.
And because there's something about that where it's a holistic system, and we realize that we need each other, that, you know, it's the work of the people, not the work of the priest, or not the work of the pastor, or the work of, you know, the projectionist or the musician. It's the work of all of us that I think is really, really important.
So if the whole church is liturgy, but then he doesn't want to diminish the fact that we gather together on Sundays for the divine liturgy. Why that is important to him is because at the heart of that is the Eucharist. And the Eucharist, as he says, is on page 26, is the entrance of the church into the joy of the Lord. And then it's the sacrament by which the church becomes what it is. So the Eucharist forms us into something. We come in as individuals scattered from, from the week. We come in, we're gathered together, and then in receiving the body and blood of Christ, we become the body of Christ again. And so there's a renewal of that identity that then allows us to be scattered again as his body. But we need to come, there's like that breathing pattern we've talked about, inhale, exhale. And the inhale is essential, or else you cannot be exhaled properly. There's not a scattering that
And it's work. Even interesting, even in the words we use for different aspects of our liturgy, we have a prayer that's called a collect, right?
Yeah.
Which comes from the word, like, to collect. It collects everybody together in prayer.
I didn't know better when I just became Anglican. I always say, like, the collect is for the week is this. And someone came to visit one time, and they're like, you say it collect. I'm like, that's so weird.
Which is which is different than colic, which is what, like, young kids get, you know, or babies. So
we don't do that.
Everybody join in the colic today, and everybody starts coughing. No, but I think that's interesting, and I think it. Schmemann also talks about the preparation for the Eucharist, and how it doesn't just begin when people start singing or when they sit down or come into the worship space, right? He actually kind of pulls it back until, you know, that morning. I believe he says, the journey begins when Christians leave their houses and their beds. They leave indeed their lives and their present and concrete world, whether they are to drive 15 miles or walk a few blocks. A sacramental act is already taking place.
This is so essential because, again, back to what we were saying earlier, you actually cannot be gathered when you're staying at home. So to think of the journey to church is not meaningless. Getting on that bus, catching that BART train, or whatever you have to do to get there, that's actually part of the liturgical act. And we would not be the same were someone to skip that part of it, you know?
And it's kind of helpful to remember on your way to church when you're stuck in traffic that this too is worship.
It's part of the liturgy.
It's part of the liturgy, and exactly. and it's probably
it may
good.
Be a very dark time. Might be a
paradox right there.
But it also can encourage us, you know, not to curse our neighbor as we're entering into worship.
Yeah. And also, I want to point out, too, that this gathering is theologically important because the very nature of the church is to be, it's called the ekklesia in Greek. And ekklesia is the called out one, called out ones. And so when we gather, we are responding to the call of God. It's not that we just decide on our own, you know, terms we're going to come. We're responding. So we're being called out from the places in the world that we live in order to gather together as a whole.
Yeah.
And so that's what ekklesia means. That's what it means to be church.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so beautiful about the way Schmemann is talking about liturgy. I think when I first came into Anglicanism, I saw liturgy as something static that we just went through. But he talks more about it as a journey to something.
And a joyful one.
Yeah.
How many people associate joy with liturgy? I think a lot of people don't.
I do.
We do now. But I think that's so interesting, especially within the Anglican tradition, like the whole idea of common prayer. Like, what's the point of that? But there's something beautiful that when we actually collect ourselves spiritually around the word throughout the week, where we're actually being formed together and we're coming together, even if we're in our individual places, there's a way that we are collecting ourselves under the same rhythm of Scripture. I know for me, that was like a key part in me entering into the Anglican tradition, because I don't know if I mentioned on the podcast, but like when I was kind of having my Anglican journey, my wife was having some medical issues with the birth of our second child, and she was on bed rest. We were isolated in a city of 20 million in China, and we didn't really have any Christian fellowship. And I was just like dying on the vine. And I was like, wait a minute, like I'm alone, stuck in this apartment, taking care of my wife and my 3-year-old daughter. How am I going to connect with others when I don't have physical fellowship? And that's when I bought like a, I think it was like a bootlegged copy of the Book of Common Prayer, and said, okay, this is something I can do. I can join the rhythm of my spiritual life with millions of people around the world. So even though it's just me and my family in this little apartment, we're entering into this fellowship, this communion with millions of people around the world who are reading and coming in under the word at the same time. And it's just so, it was so powerful. And like, once you tasted that, once I tasted that, I couldn't go back.
And imagine if in that setting where you had to be by necessity isolated, if somebody from a church within 20, 30 minutes of there brought you sacrament.
Oh, I know.
It would have been like filling full that whole meaning of like, I'm not alone. I'm actually part of this body. And so that's actually, we've talked about this before in the podcast. That's why reserve sacrament and taking it to the sick or to the people who are isolated or in prison or whatever else, that's a really important part of being the body of Christ together, as we don't want to leave those people out there isolated. Mm-hmm. So thank God that you in that experience received the nurture of common prayer, but there was something that probably grew up really hungry inside of you.
Exactly. And I remember still the first time I actually took Eucharist after that experience. And it was completely different because I had journeyed with so many people and with the church that I had never even been at yet. Already we had journeyed together. And I think this is an important thing too. Like as he says, you know, we begin the journey when we leave our houses and then we leave our beds on Sunday morning. But also in the Anglican tradition, a lot of the collects and the prayers Saturday night are these preparatory prayers about preparing your hearts and minds to enter into Sunday morning, and how even just the whole rhythms of the church, the feasts, the fast, common prayer, you know, the daily office and everything, is kind of this coming together and this kind of, there's this movement in this journey where all these activities of the church, the weekly liturgies or the daily liturgies lead us to the Sunday Eucharist or to the Eucharist whenever it's being celebrated, kind of almost like being in an airport, like having one of those moving walkways that you kind of hop on and you're being led somewhere.
I was reading a book by a guy named Gerhard Lofink recently. It's called Does God Need the Church? And he puts a lot of emphasis in this book on the need for what he calls unanimity. Another way to say that would be solidarity, like a unity that is not uniformity. Unanimity is we all agree we're doing this together. And I feel like in our scattered individualistic age, it's really hard to get that sense of solidarity and unanimity. And so the coming together in the gathering, we experience that tangibly. We all receive from the same cup, and then we all receive from the same bread. You know, there's a unanimity there. But then in the scattering, what you're talking about, Josh, was really important, that we maintain that unanimity in our shared prayer life, in our shared rhythms of feasting and fasting. And it helps us maintain a distinctive identity in the midst of all the cultural currents that are pushing us into niches and other directions and pushing against the unanimity of the church.
And it gives, I think, rhythm and structure to this active relationship with Christ. Like something I was actually thinking about this morning after morning prayer was like, there's kind of, it comes in waves, it seems, in culture, where there's kind of waves where songs or different sermons or different things on Facebook come where Christianity is about relationship, not religion, you know? And there's a part of that that I really sympathize with, because what they mean by religion is something that's more ritualism or sacramentalism, as I think Schmemann would say, that divorces itself from the heart and from joy. But one of the epiphanies I had when I was thinking about that was like, wait a minute, you have all these people saying, you know, I'm not about religion, I'm about relationship. But then also culturally, we suck at relationships. Like right now, we don't know how to carry on relationships. Most of our relationships are broken. And so when we say, oh, you know, it's all about my relationship with Christ, it's like, how do you do that? Because all my other relationships are cracked and broken and need support. And I think that's one of the roles of liturgy, is this, it gives structure and guidance to this living relationship. It's not contradictory. It's not like an either or, but a both and, where it's saying, you know, this rhythm helps you to actually cultivate a healthy relationship with Christ.
It would be like trying to build a big tall building without a scaffolding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You need scaffolding to hold things together. The point is not scaffolding, but you need that. It's necessary as well. Well, in our next discussion, we're going to pick up somewhere around page 27 in our conversation and continue on with that. So I look forward to talking more with you folks.
Yeah. Tune in next time where we continue our discussion of chapter 2 of For the Life of the World.